From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get the latest on Tropical Storm Harvey, which made landfall again today, moving from Texas to Louisiana. But there is some relief in Houston. The National Weather Service announced this morning that the Tropical Storm Warning, Storm Surge, and Flash Flood Watch have all been canceled there. The storm poured nearly 52 inches of rain east of Houston, breaking a record for the most measured rainfall from a single storm in the continental U.S. Joining us now is Craig Cohen, host of Houston Matters on Houston Public Media. Craig, tell us how it's going there. Are you still seeing any rain at this point, or has it stopped?
I am so pleased to say the rain has stopped, and Harvey has left behind most of the greater Houston region. Now, that said, the storms moved eastward. Areas in far east Texas, including Beaumont, really took it on the chin last night and are still seeing some rain this morning. In fact, one shelter in Port Arthur, Texas, that's about 100 miles east of Houston, flooded around 8 o'clock last night, and people there had to be evacuated a second time. And the forecast now is finally looking really good. We could still see a shower or two today, but otherwise sunshine into Saturday, which is great news.
And what about the water levels around the city? Are they starting to recede at all?
Well, anecdotally, yes, but with a caveat. First of all, the Brazos River in Fort Bend County is still expected to crest at about 57.5 feet tomorrow. That would exceed the normal flood stage by 12 feet and surpass the current record by nearly 3 feet. Evacuation orders have been in effect for large portions of Fort Bend County near the Brazos. And yet, for other portions of Greater Houston, we're starting to see streets starting to drain as they are designed to do. There are still many, many impassable roads and stretches of highway. And the best advice is still to stay put yet one more day. But as you might imagine, after 4 days of being holed up, Houstonians are starting to travel around a little bit. Some area restaurants and stores have opened back up over the last 24 or 48 hours or so, some of them even serving as makeshift shelters. Still, Houstonians who aren't flooded out need to be very cautious about where they go and how they get there. There are limited routes from one location to another, and first responders, of course, still need to travel around to see if there are others left to rescue.
And what about the reservoirs? We know that yesterday two reservoirs spilled over into neighborhoods that hadn't already been flooded. Is there still a concern with Houston's reservoirs?
Yeah, these are the Attucks and Barker reservoirs, and the Army Corps of Engineers did some targeted releases from those reservoirs. And basically what they did was, by releasing a little bit of water and getting people out of those neighborhoods that were in greatest threat of it as best they could, that kept Buffalo Bayou from spilling over and flooding the city in a more massive fashion. It does look like the worst in terms of both weather and flooding may now be behind us. But of course, that's just the first stage in a long effort in terms of relief and then recovery.
We spoke yesterday with NPR's John Burnett, who's there in Houston, and he was talking about rescues just going on all around him. Helicopters would swoop down and pick people up. Is that still happening? Are the rescues still ongoing?
Oh, they're still pursuing them, yes, wherever they can. In general terms, we've seen thousands of rescues. Close to 10,000 people found their way to a shelter at the George R. Brown Convention Center over the last 24, 36 hours. That's really the bigger issue now is once people are rescued, getting them to shelters and then getting them as quickly as possible settled and then out of those shelters into temporary housing. That's the big transition process that's going to happen over the next few days, hopefully.
Over the next few days, how long do officials in Houston think that people are going to have to be in temporary shelters?
I think it's maybe just a little too soon yet to say. Just yesterday, they opened up an additional mega shelter. There have been shelters opened up. Area mosques around town have opened their doors, area high schools. People are going to be there for a while, and how long that while is, I can't tell you.
I remember being in New York City during Hurricane Sandy, and when the government would come in and say, okay, we're now doing only 3 people in a car coming into the city and things like that, people obeyed. They said, okay, this is what we have to do to get through this. I know that Houston has now put in place a curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 in the morning. How are Houstonians feeling about how the government is responding?
generally speaking, it seems pretty positive. People are heeding warnings from local officials. I know there has been some talk, and to be honest with you, we hadn't paid a whole lot of attention to it, but that there was some talk in social media, primarily from people outside of Greater Houston, saying, well, why didn't local officials just evacuate everybody right. from Houston? You can't do that with 6.5 million people. And in fact, the last time they tried that about a decade ago during Rita, it led to many more deaths on highways when people got stranded and couldn't go anywhere.
That's Craig Cohen, who is host of Houston Matters on Houston Public Media in Houston, of course, where it is finally not raining anymore. Craig, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So let's turn to the health concerns and bring in Dr. Regina Rodman, a head and neck surgeon and a Houston resident who'd gone downtown to the convention center to bring donations. And they said, you're a doctor, you have to stay. So she did. She's back home now. Her neighborhood spared serious flooding. She joins us by Skype. Dr. Rodman, what did you see at the convention center?
So the most shocking and overwhelming thing was just the number of people that were pouring in. In the medical area, I saw really a wide variety of things. I had one patient who was having chest pains with a history of heart problems. I had a couple older patients with COPD that were having respiratory problems, problems breathing. Same thing, we had a series of little kids with asthma who are, you know, predisposed to respiratory problems. And that was stuff that we could treat at the center with nebulizers and putting people on oxygen. I had one patient who had had a very infected elbow from a cut that he had gotten a few days ago, but because he was unable to get treatment and just kind of sitting in nasty water, it had gotten really infected.
Talk about that water for a second. I know you were inside the convention center, but we're hearing from mayors and others that a huge concern is some of, you know, what's in that water and some of the illnesses they might be facing. Plus, people don't have that much clean water. As a doctor, what are you worried about?
So in the shelter, there's always a concern about waterborne illnesses spreading. And there were some patients who were ill with like nausea and vomiting, which may be a stomach flu that they had picked up, you know, before the floods. Mm-hmm. But we're always concerned about the spread of infectious diseases. And so they're trying to, as best they can, take all the health precautions possible, like keeping cots spaced a certain amount, making sure that there's plenty of hand sanitizer, trying to get people to just throw away clothes that have been in floodwaters. Because all that is infected with sewage and tar from roads and, you know.
And everything that everyone has had in their garage, you know, for probably 20 years. I mean, all of
exactly.
that is in the water. Yeah. And you mentioned cots, but you tell us you saw people and, you know, we've seen this before. This is a convention center that's set up for, I think, 5,000. They've got double that and they're catching up, but there were not enough cots.
Correct. So when I originally got there 2 days ago, I think by midnight that night, there was probably at least 1,000 people, maybe more, who didn't have any bedding. And so it was really crazy to just see. It was families, you know, sharing a blanket, sleeping on the concrete floor. At one point, they started passing out cardboard boxes, and then people were clamoring to grab cardboard boxes to use as beds.
Oh, boy. Look, what about you in your professional life? You know, there are hospitals, but they're on skeleton crews, 72-hour shifts. Are you going to be going back and doing surgeries?
Yeah, we're hoping to reopen our office and our surgery center tomorrow. Luckily, a lot of the stuff that I do is elective. So I've been in touch with my patients over email. I'm having them email me pictures of their surgical sites and their wounds to just make sure that everything looks okay.
Yeah.
And we're doing kind of like a little clinic via email.
The fact that you're a surgeon makes us think about, you know, people have everyday health issues. There are probably people who were scheduled for serious surgeries who can't get there. There are probably people who just had surgery recovering from it at a home that's flooded. I mean, what are some of the other things you think of?
Well, that was some of the things that I did see at the convention center is a couple of people who have just chronic wounds that they have a wound care nurse come and dress them and kind of provide them with care on a daily basis. And, you know, they weren't acutely infected or needing anything, but they just needed their usual scheduled help.
Were you also seeing that there's going to be a need for emotional care?
Yeah. And I think that's probably at least half of what I did the times I was at the convention center is it was hard like that. There was a patient that I mentioned I sent to the hospital for chest pain, and his he was there actually with his elderly mother who was also trying to take care of their family dogs. And so she had to choose between staying with the dogs or trying to go with her son to the hospital. And so just to stay and kind of comfort her and help get her tucked into bed and, you know, reassure her that I think he'll be fine and he'll probably be back in the morning. I think that was probably the best care that I provided.
Well, and we were glad you were there. That's Dr. Regina Rodman, a head and neck surgeon in Houston who went to the convention center to bring a donation. And they said, please stay. You're a doctor. Dr. Rodman, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This morning, President Trump tweeted, quote, "After witnessing firsthand the horror and devastation caused by Hurricane Harvey, my heart goes out even more so to the great people of Texas." That was after Trump was criticized for not meeting with storm victims on his visit to Texas yesterday. On Fox News yesterday, former George W. Bush press secretary Ari Fleischer said Trump's response in Texas was lacking.
There was something missing from what President Trump said. I hope he will say it later today. But that's the empathy for the people who suffer. That, in my opinion, should have been the first thing he should have said, was that his heart goes out to those people in Houston who are going through this and that the government is here to help them to recover from this.
Let's bring in our political analyst, Karine Jean-Pierre, who is a Democratic strategist. Hi, Karine.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let me start with you right there. Do you agree with some of the criticism from Ari Fleischer and others that President Trump should have met with victims or should have shown more empathy on his visit?
I mean, listen, I think that it doesn't matter what this president does. I think there's always going to be detractors like never before. I think when you look at the nature of the trip, it was designed for the president to go down and tour what he did with the First Lady and several members of the cabinet, the Operations Center, to make sure and to ensure the nation and the people there that are suffering that the federal government is working in lockstep in collaboration with the local government to ensure that they get the necessary aid that they need. Look, when the president goes down, it's a big ordeal. This is why he could not go to certain areas that he actually wanted to go to. Because he takes away resources for those very needed people that need it the most when they go down there. So I don't think that his response was inappropriate. And I think that the statement that he made at the fire station, which was impromptu, showed his empathy when he said, and I quote, "I just wanted to say we love you. You are special. We're here to take care of you. It's going well. And I want to thank you all for coming out. We're going to get back and get back to you and operating immediately. Thank you, everybody." I mean, I think that that shows his commitment to the crowd. And the fact that these people stood out there to show their appreciation to the president and the First Lady of the United States coming down to the area that's been affected by this horrific flood is also a testament to the people that were there appreciated the president and the entire government going down. The vice president will be going down there as well.
Karine, I imagine you don't agree with that analysis, but tell us what you think. I mean, it was unusual because usually if you look back at some of the pictures that have come out of former presidents going to disaster zones, they're hugging victims and things like that.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I worked on the Obama campaign in 2012 when, unfortunately, the hurricane that hit New Jersey and New York and the kind of like the tri-state area hit. And it was a different, certainly different photos came out of that. And I worked in the administration the first 2 years of administration. So you know, and I know Paris has also worked in an administration for George W. Bush. So he has a sense of what all of this is supposed to look like. But Jerry, I want to go a little bit deeper here. So I think you know, Donald Trump needs to realize, like, this is not a one-day TV show, right? This is going to be a long, complicated process of rebuilding the fourth largest city in our country. And here's where I think is the real question. Can he have the focus to really bring the resources forward to look at this long term? And I say this because if you look at the Department of Homeland Security, if you look at FEMA, if you look at the Small Business Administration, which are the agencies that are going to be focusing on and leading the way on rebuilding the Gulf Coast area, they don't have the necessary staff that they they need. And it's something that Donald Trump can't blame the Senate because he hasn't brought forth nominees, crucial, important nominees for key positions in those three administrations. And so that's a problem. Secondly, when you look at the budget that he put forth and to Congress a couple months ago, it gutted programs in FEMA. It gutted programs at DHS. It gutted programs at Small Business Administration. So here we're starting at a place where you have a president that doesn't seem to have the will or the desire to look at these things long term. And now he's heading to Missouri for a political event. So 24 hours, where are we now? He's back to doing political campaigning.
Well, I want to ask you about that, Paris, about whether it is too soon to start shifting the focus to tax reform or not. But on the issue of long term, there's also the issue of climate change. Now, we cannot tie any storm directly to climate change, but this is what the experts have been saying forever. We're going to have more and more powerful storms. Is it time for the country to have another conversation about that, especially just a few months after President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement?
I think it's time for tax reform, and I think a lot of people are in need of it. A lot of small businesses want it, and I think it's going to be the catalyst to jumpstart the Make America Great Again plan to bring more jobs and to help these small businesses employ more people and put more money in their pockets. And so this isn't a political thing. This is something that is policy, and it's important, and it was already pre-planned. And because of this horrific hurricane that happened, the president decided that it was important for him to go down there. And it's not his first time. I mean, this won't be his last trip. He's going down again this week. The vice president is going down there as well. And he was there with the federal government, and they already gave $10 million worth of aid through the Department of Labor. And so they understand the long-term benefits of it. And there's been universal praise for the new FEMA director that's been in there. And the coordination has been like never before. This president gets it. He understands it, and he understands the long haul. All of the cabinet understands it as well, and they don't want to mess this up. That's why he went down there once, and that's why they're going down there again, and that's why the vice president and other cabinet members are going to do so. But as it relates to climate change, look, you can have a conversation on climate change if you want to, but the people that are suffering in Houston want results. They want action, and that's what this administration is going to deliver and focus on.
But this is what we heard from Congressman Pete Olson, who we spoke with today, who said this is not the time to talk about climate change. But when is the time to talk about climate change, especially if it is leading to more powerful storms like this?
Well, there, like you said before, there is no direct correlation between climate change and Hurricane Harvey. And so you can have a greater conversation about climate change if you want to. But we should have conversations about disaster preparedness. We should have conversations about how governments should react in times of and having plans in place to help rescue senior citizens and help rescue children and animals, which are all affected by this hurricane. And what you do with businesses, we saw the largest refinery go under it. And that affects the economy as well. So that's the conversation I hope that this administration has with the local municipalities and the American people.
Well, as you listed off all of those things, I realize we are covering each one of those aspects of the story today. Corrine, your thoughts, though.
Look, a few weeks ago, Trump slashed flood protections just before Harvey hit, obviously, and that was going to set the standards for infrastructure, right? As it related to climate change, and so that was something really important. Like we said, we can't yet connect this, or it may not be connected to Harvey, but this is really important. Like stuff like this when we're talking about policy, like these are the policies that's going to be important for cities like Houston, the fourth largest cities, to know that when they're building infrastructure, can it be protected with flooding? And so this is the thing. He's slashing policies. He's not staffing up. He's cutting budgets. And it doesn't seem like he's here or he cares about the long term. He hasn't done any of those things to show that he cares about the long term. People are suffering. People are literally dying in Houston. And now we have Louisiana that was hit by flooding overnight. So this is the whole entire Gulf Coast, and this is really incredibly important. And he just hasn't. It's like, yes, a few trips to Texas, Louisiana, that's fine. I think he might go back down there on Saturday. That's something that needs to happen. But how is he truly, truly going to fix things and help his the different agencies that I had just mentioned, DHS, SBA, and FEMA, how are they going to lead if they don't have the funding?
Paris, I want to ask you about another topic in the news in the last 24 hours. The Defense Secretary, James Mattis, is putting President Trump's transgender military ban on hold while he studies it. What do you make of that, that a military leader is saying, hang on, Mr. President, we're going to look into this first?
I think that the president has tremendous faith in Secretary Mattis and believes that he's going to do the right thing. And that's the appropriate thing for him to do as the heads of the Defense Department. He's going to say, while we do this, while the study is going on, we're going to put a hold on it, let the study happen, and then do the implementation. It's a responsible thing to do. The president has an order that came out by the direction that he wants to take the U.S. military. The State Department, I mean, the Department of Defense is going to do the study and put a hold on it. That's what you want. You want to have responsible government, and that is what is happening. It's good coordination, and it's a responsible thing to do.
Do you think that there's a chance that after the study that they will decide not to ban transgender people serving in the military?
I think we have a president who believes in listening to the commanders on the ground, the generals in the field, and his cabinet secretary. So if there's a good case to be made that makes a lot of sense in terms of readiness, in terms of the cost, and in terms of the things that go into being prepared for the tremendous battles that we might have to face with the threats from North Korea and otherwise, I think the president will is open to changing his mind. But until that happens, he set the course and believes that it's the right thing to do. The study will commence and we'll see what happens.
Kareem, we just have about 30 seconds left, but your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the Mattis situation is very interesting. Basically, he went as close as possible to not obeying an order as legally allowed. Right. And good for him. Also shows how isolated Trump is, even from his own cabinet. I mean, we're talking about General Mattis here, who likes to follow the law and orders. Right. And I think for him to take that step, says a lot.
That's Karine Jean-Pierre, a Democratic strategist, and Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
We're keeping an eye on Tropical Storm Harvey, but we're also following other news. A new study in the journal Human Reproduction shows the average age of first-time fathers in the U.S. is rising and is now nearly 31 years old. Joining us now to discuss is Megan Thielking, reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Megan, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
And tell us more about the findings in this research.
This new study found that new dads are actually older than they've been in decades. They're now about 31 years old at the time of their baby's birth, and that's a big jump up from around 27 in the early 1970s.
And do we know what's behind that?
The researchers speculate that it kind of correlates with this similar trend that we've seen in moms, which is that parents in general are waiting later to start their families.
How does it vary by race and other geographic differences?
So there are some clear differences when you break the numbers down into different groups. So dads in the Northeast are the oldest, for example, and men who had college degrees are older when their babies are born than men with only a high school education. And the researchers also broke it down by race and ethnicity and found that Japanese and Vietnamese American fathers are actually the oldest among all of those groups.
And you say that women are also starting their families later.
Yeah, researchers have seen a similar trend in moms. A study that was out last year actually found that women are starting families later, too. But the main force behind that trend was actually a dramatic drop in the teen birth rate, which sort of drove up the age that women give birth to their first child.
What's happening to the difference between the man and the woman in a relationship when they decide to have kids and the age?
So the gap in age between moms and dads is actually narrowing. So in 2015, dads were 2.3 years older than the mothers of their kids, and that's a decrease from the gap that we saw a couple decades ago. And the researchers suspect that's due in part to more women deciding to enter the workforce and holding off on having kids earlier in their careers.
So I imagine that a lot of people now at the age that they're deciding to have children are doing so at that point as opposed to earlier because maybe they don't have enough money to afford to have a kid. Maybe they've got a lot of student debt, something like that. Are there downsides to men waiting until later to have kids?
Previous studies have shown that the male germline actually develops mutations every year. So as dads get older, researchers think that those inherited mutations could actually become more common in the population and potentially impact public health. But at the same time, the researchers say there's benefits to it too. So, for example, dads that are between 35 and 44 and perhaps are more settled in their careers and settled financially are more likely to live with their kids and have more of a role in raising them.
So what does this mean for the rest of us, for our population?
So as the paternal age has increased a few years, that might seem like a very small shift, just 4 years, but it's actually likely to make a dent on the demographics over time, because men who wait longer to have kids, it's sort of been associated that they may also then have fewer children, and the same thing for women. So family sizes may shrink as we see men and women wait longer to have kids.
That's Megan Thielking, who is a reporter with our partners at STAT. Megan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we'll link you to more about this research at hereandnow.org. If you are an older father, let us know how it's working out for you. Why did you decide to wait to have kids? What are the benefits and downsides to being an older dad? Hereandnow.org.
At least 30,000 people fleeing floodwaters in Texas are living in shelters across the state. But as we've been hearing, a third of those are crammed into the convention center in downtown Houston. The population far exceeds capacity, as we've been saying, from an expected 5,000 people on Monday to double that yesterday. Christopher Connolly of KERA says the convention center is a scene of hope, tragedy, and reunion.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, this is all going to go down to the last exhibit room. They have
all day long, people streamed past loading docks and empty trucks at the back of the convention center, hauling bulging bags of donations into the cavernous exhibition rooms that have been turned into dormitories. Each donated item is added to the massive piles to be sorted and handed out to thousands of people displaced by the storm.
Blanket, towels can go over where the pets are as well, because they have showers over there.
Okay.
Blankets and stuff.
Jennifer Miller and her friends came with plastic bags filled with diapers, dog food, tampons, bedding, anything they could think of. Miller says she's lucky because the floods spared her this time.
My family house flooded in Tropical Storm Allison, so I know what it's like to lose pretty much everything. So, yeah, just definitely wanted to come and try to help if I could.
Evacuees wait in line for donated clothes, toiletries, shoes.
10 and a half in men.
These are the basic necessities that the floodwater stole. Demetrius Washington is in line for cartons of packaged foods. He came with his mother on Sunday after his home in the Lakewood neighborhood flooded. He'd been worried since he'd lost contact with his grandmother during the storm.
I seen on the news that her neighborhood got flooded and everything, and I stopped watching because I got depressed.
But this morning, his mother Ramona got a text message. It was his grandma. She was at the convention center, and now he's searching for her among seemingly endless rows of green army-style cots.
Getting that text message and her saying that she's here, I mean, I feel relieved now. I know she's all right.
Washington's friends Lee Benford and Crystal White say what a lot of people here have been saying. They didn't think it would get like this, that the flooding would be so bad. They hunkered down to wait it out, like officials advised, but the rain was unrelenting, the bayou near their house spilling over its banks.
The water was just rushing
in the house.
Rushing.
Yeah.
The sound of the rain on their tin car park roof was deafening. Inside, they watched their belongings floating in the floodwaters, panic rising with the water. Finally, a neighbor with a boat saved them.
Water steady rising where I live, and he came and got us out. That was our only means, because the water was passing my mailbox.
It was all the way to the bottom of our window.
Benford says he's never seen anything like this, but for Crystal White, it was all too familiar. It was a dozen years ago today. She was in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit Louisiana.
And it's just like a repeat again. Today marks 12 years, so it's, you know, it's devastating. And to lose everything else again and start all over, I mean, it's very hard, you know. And I'm trying to just stay focused and positive, but it's just too much, you know?
White says she does feel lucky her children were at her mom's house this weekend, four kids, all between 5 and 10 years old. But this brings back painful memories of just how hard her family had to struggle to rebuild lives in a city full of strangers after Katrina.
Honestly, to me, it just feel like, I mean, I don't know, it's like giving up. I'm not like, I don't know what else to do.
Her husband also feels lost.
I never been through this before. I'm supposed to be the man, supposed to be the one she can look up to, And I just thank her for being strong, and I was able to lean on her, you know.
Yeah, I was.
I just hope everybody be okay, because this was hard.
By the day's end, with the convention center past its capacity and need continuing to grow, Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner announced a second massive shelter just a few blocks away. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Connolly in Houston.
Just an incredible human tragedy. But we've also seen images from Houston in the past few days of people desperately trying to save animals from the flooding. Dogs, cats, horses, even a Texas longhorn was trapped in the rising water. Joining us now is Vicky Croak, who covers the animal world for us. Hi, Vicky.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what can you tell us about what these animals are going through?
Well, you know, those pictures really do tell a story. The man in a suburb of Houston carrying his German Shepherd Heidi and holding her head just above the water's surface as he pushes through a rescue boat near his home. A group of people huddled under a tarp. A woman's son is clutching the family dog. People hugging their dogs and weeping into their fur. We know tens of thousands of people in the area have needed to find emergency shelter, and the disaster is evolving minute by minute, Texas and Louisiana. So we don't yet know how many animals have been or will be affected, but obviously it will also be in the thousands. With Katrina, some people say hundreds of thousands of animals were displaced or killed.
I was just watching a video of somebody going out into what looked like a raging river to rescue a dog. What do the rescue efforts look like? Are people going out in boats?
It's definitely a huge part of what the animal groups are doing there. There are rescue teams navigating boats and trucks, as you say, through dangerous conditions. They're going door to door to do rescues. We've seen some of those. And Katie Jarl is the Texas State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. She's working out of San Antonio and coordinating all kinds of rescue work. She told me several stories, including one about a Rottweiler rescued from by some members of her team. The dog was trapped in a flooded garage and had scrambled on top of some boxes to stay above the waterline. So he was tired and hungry, but pretty happy when he saw his rescuers. There were firefighters and emergency workers and volunteers also out in boats, and they're spotting animals who need rescuing, animals on their own or with their companion humans.
Is there a concern, though, that people might be taking too many risks to save animals when doing so could be really dangerous for the humans?
Yeah, that is always an issue. People are driven by their fear and love of their pets, and they're making drastic decisions. The people being sent in by the animal groups are really elite and experienced disaster rescuers. They're on the scene in Texas and Louisiana now. These are really dangerous waters. They're warning people as much as possible to leave the rescue to the experts. Many of the rescue workers have spoken about the lessons of Katrina and knowing that people then and now will risk their lives to stay with or rescue their companion animals, and that also, there will be animals left behind who need rescue. I spoke with Katie Jarl. She told me, plain and simple, saving animals is saving people. Hmm. And that's how she views her team's ongoing work there. Our connection to animals is deep and important. And she says keeping beloved pets safe, you know, gives people hope when they've lost everything else.
Well, when they're able to keep those pets safe and then they end up in a shelter, what happens to the pets?
Well, with so many animals coming in and many, many more expected, obviously space is at a premium. So one of the most important strategies for the rescue groups is relocating the adoptable animals who are already in area animal shelters. That's before the storm. These animals really need good homes. They're adoptable. And so they're taking them to other parts of the country, helping them get adopted. And it makes room for the incoming animals rescued by the storm. And animals whose owners need or will need a temporary and safe place for their pets until they're able to take them back. So that effort's well underway.
Now, Vicky, it's not just domestic animals. We've seen some incredible images of wildlife reacting to this storm. There are colonies of fire ants floating on the water to survive the flood.
Yeah, along with deer and raccoons and squirrels, the animals we think of as seeking higher dry ground. This is a part of the country with alligators. So there have been reports of alligators showing up in unexpected places. And then these so-called rafts consisting of thousands of displaced venomous fire ants having been spotted in the floodwaters around Houston. And their stings are pretty painful and can be dangerous to those sensitive to the venom.
Last thing you want to see in the water if you are stuck in that water. What can people do to help the pets?
All the groups involved, Houston SPCA, SPCA of Texas, HSUS, and more, they're taking donations right now. A lot of them want monetary donations because they don't want to be
sifting through other kinds of food, et cetera. You should check with your local shelter. They may have some of these animals coming up from that area. And all of those places will be needing foster homes for a lot of these animals who are coming in.
That's Vicky Croak, who covers all things animal for us at Here and Now. Vicky, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Port Arthur, Texas, population about 55,000, is underwater. Floodwaters rose overnight as Harvey hovered overhead and dropped a record-setting 26 inches of rain in 24 hours, putting the total rainfall there at 3.5 feet. Evacuees sleeping on cots overnight at the Bob Bauer Civic Center woke in cots bobbing in water that seeped in overnight. The largest oil refinery in the country is located in Port Arthur. Its operations shut down earlier today. NPR's Debbie Elliott has been driving around the whole region, reporting from the region. She's in Beaumont, Texas, about 20 miles north of Port Arthur, where there's also been disastrous widespread flooding. She joins us on her cell phone. Debbie, start with Port Arthur. What are you hearing from there?
Well, it's major flooding. You know, the mayor there, Derek Freeman, posted on Facebook early today that his whole city was underwater. He just recently sort of put up a video where he was walking through a couple of feet of water in his house, promising that the military, the Coast Guard, all city assets are out trying to help people and that people should call 911 if they are trapped in their homes. They've even got the city's dump trucks out trying to get to people because those are the only vehicles that can get through high water. As you mentioned, the Civic Center that was being used as a shelter flooded, so people had to be rescued and moved elsewhere. There was an apartment fire complex overnight that was a huge problem. Right now, they've turned a bowling alley into an emergency shelter for people. I was talking to somebody here at my hotel in Beaumont, one of the people that works here, and his aunt is trapped in her attic in Port Arthur, waving, you know, things out of the window in the attic, trying to get people to come and get her.
Well, at least she has a window to wave something out, because I know
right.
The mayor also said, you know, try to stay away
don't
from
go
the,
in the attic.
Right.
Because right. Take an axe if you're
right.
going in, because you don't want to be trapped with the water rising in the roof above you.
Oh, just terrible. Look, the mayor also said, we're coming to get you. But it's sounding
right.
as if they can't. The county sheriff, Zena Stevens, told a TV station there they can't get to Port Arthur. And in Beaumont, where you are, is also flooding. So this is pretty serious.
It's a real issue, and it's overwhelming for the local authorities here. They're putting everything they've got on it. And then there are volunteers who are also helping, people who are just putting their boats out. In fact, the sheriff here said, okay, we're going to meet at this dry parking lot at the Walmart. If you bring your boat, we'll tell you where to go. Because they just have a queue of people who are waiting to get out. You know, more than 3 feet of rain has come in this region, and there's just nowhere for the water to go.
Debbie, and we know you've been driving around very early today. We saw pictures of gridlock as people on I-10, Interstate 10, were just desperate to flee. Instead, they were standing still later in the day.
Well I-10 yeah. is closed.
Yes.
And no, I'm not driving around because my island, my hotel in Beaumont is an island. I cannot get out because of water on the roads. I was out for a short time yesterday and had to turn back quickly. So I-10 is closed. If you're trying to get from Louisiana into Texas, you just can't. It's not safe, and they don't want people on the roads because that's where people die. There was a fatality here in Beaumont where a woman was in a car. It was swamped with water. She got out with her toddler daughter, and rushing floodwaters got her. The child survived by floating on her mother's body. It's just a horrible story. Mm.
Well, that was going to be my question, because I saw the cars gridlocked very early this morning, and then I saw a picture going around of, you know, white caps on I-10, and, you know, I wondered what happened to those cars, and here's this terrible, terrible story.
There are hundreds, if not thousands, of cars that are underwater.
You have seen, you know, people who are charged with trying to tell people about this news weeping on television. I mean, give us more of a sense of what's going on there.
Yeah, it's overwhelming to watch this happen to your home community. And last night at one point, the weatherman on the local TV just started weeping. You know, people have been nonstop trying to help each other, saying, this is what you need to do. Here are answers to your questions. But it's overwhelming for people. It's also overwhelming for the 911 systems here. You know, this is a catastrophe of epic proportions. And it's not just here. It's all across this coast.
Thankfully, you turned back. We're thankful that you're not driving around as you have been for so many days now, helping us understand this story. But what's going to happen? Another town cut off, that means no food, no water, probably no electricity. What do you foresee? And not only
there are scattered power outages. The challenge is, when will people be able to get in here and how? Right now, it's a matter of rescuing people. Then you start to figure out how to take care of the people who have been rescued. And at some point, you know, the waters are going to recede and people are going to have to go home and muck out. But the bad news is that some of these rivers and bayous in this area, they're going to continue flooding for like a week to come. So the floodwaters could persist.
Yeah.
So already you've got more than 200,000 people registered for help from FEMA, and that number is likely to double.
NPR's Debbie Elliott reporting from Beaumont, Texas, where she is surrounded by water, 20 miles north of Port Arthur, which is completely underwater. Debbie, thank you so much for your reporting.
You're welcome.